Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Robert Dreyfus, who discusses his investigation into a secret Pentagon unit which produced the false intelligence that led to the Bush administration's war on Iraq. Anna Avendano, senior advisor on immigration issues for the AFL-CIO, who explains why the labor movement opposes President Bush's initiative for reforming the nation's immigration laws. And Joan Mulhern, senior legislative counsel at Earth Justice, who discusses the campaign in Appalachian communities to stop the coal company practice of mountaintop removal and the environmental and social impact of this method of mining. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that Iran is heading towards a political showdown between pro-democracy reformers who run the parliament and hardline clerics who have just banned 80 members of parliament from seeking re-election in a February ballot. On January 11th, nearly 100 pro-reform activists held an all-night sit-in to protest the ruling by the hardline Council of Guardians to ban the reform candidates. The council is a hand-picked group of 12 clerics and Islamic lawyers. So far, the Iranian government, run by reform-minded President Mohammad Khatami, has hinted it may ignore the ruling and put the banned candidates on the ballot. Provincial governors in charge of running the parliamentary election have promised to resign unless the ban is lifted. The president's brother, Mohammad Reza Khatami, who heads Iran's largest political party, the Participation Front, is on the list of those banned from seeking re-election. The ongoing conflict between the reformers and the clerics, who hold the highest authority under Iran's Islamic constitution, is all the more intense because of the upcoming February 25th anniversary of Iran's revolution. As the reform leader Mohsen Mirdamadi concluded, this is not an election any longer, but the appointment of members of parliament by hardliners. The news magazine In These Times reports that 10 months before the 2004 presidential election, progressive groups have already begun a campaign seeking to identify voters needed to oust President George W. Bush. Groups like the AFL-CIO, Emily's List, the Sierra Club, and others are identifying new voters and engaging in long-term issue education. These groups call themselves America Coming Together, America Votes, and Environment 2004. These so-called 527 groups, an IRS designation, are designed to get around the new federal soft money ban. For the first time in over 20 years, the push is on long-term direct voter contact and not on flashy media campaigns. In New York, for example, the state's feisty healthcare union, Service Employees International Union District 1199, is offering to pay the salaries of workers for a year to canvass in battleground states. One, Voices for Working Families, started door-knocking in Florida a full year before the 2004 election. The Bush White House is trying to gear up its own voter drives, including a campaign to sign up 4 million evangelical voters. Yet Steve Rosenthal, who heads America Coming Together, says progressives will beat Bush at voter registration. Our vote is more expandable, the former labor organizer insists. Our mission is to expand the electorate by registering hundreds of thousands of blacks, Latinos, women, and union voters. According to a study by the Center for Public Integrity, radio ownership consolidation is widespread, with one media company owning at least one-third of all stations in 43 different metropolitan areas. Since the deregulation push started with the Telecommunications Act of 1996, radio powerhouse Clear Channel has amassed over 1,200 stations, predominantly in small and medium-sized cities. Another big radio company, Citadel Communications, has focused on smaller markets because they're less competitive, provide a larger portion of revenue from local advertisers, and there is greater opportunity for media concentration. In Albany, Georgia, Cumulus Media, which owns half the area's radio stations, banned the Dixie Chicks from its playlist after singer Natalie Maines criticized President Bush at a London concert. But in the face of an FCC decision to further deregulate rules governing broadcasters, the public rose up in an unprecedented wave of opposition, pressuring Congress to consider legislation reversing the FCC rules. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
We'll be right back.
As November's presidential election draws nearer, more information is being revealed about the dubious evidence, exaggerations, and misrepresentations used by the Bush administration to justify its war to remove Saddam Hussein from power. Former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill recently made headlines with comments in a new book and an interview on CBS TV's 60 Minutes program, in which he says that the White House started planning their war against Iraq 8 months before the September 11th terrorist attacks, shortly after President Bush was sworn into office. Secretary of State Colin Powell recently declared that there is no evidence connecting Saddam Hussein's government with the al-Qaeda terrorist network, contradicting numerous statements made by the White House to rally public support for the war. Even as David Kaye, the Bush administration's chief post-war weapons inspector, announced his departure from his position, a 400-man team assigned to find Saddam's weapons of mass destruction was withdrawn from Iraq. A report written by a research professor at the U.S. Army War College asserts that the war in Iraq was unnecessary and diverted attention and resources from the threat posed by al-Qaeda. Adding to the body of evidence indicating the Bush White House employed deception and dishonest intelligence assessments to aid their war effort is an investigative report in Mother Jones magazine titled The Lie Factory, detailing the existence of a secret Pentagon unit used to create the case for invading Iraq, leading the nation to war. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Robert Dreyfus, who co-wrote the article along with Jason Vest. He explains how the White House used a network of Defense Department offices and think tanks to launch a preemptive war.
We now know from listening to Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary, that the Bush administration intended to invade Iraq before 9/11. In other words, the invasion of Iraq had nothing to do with the war on terrorism and everything to do with a much broader strategic policy that the Bush administration was pursuing. And in my article, I say the same thing, that the effort to build a plan to go into Iraq started really on the first day of the Bush administration or after the inauguration, when his national security team met. And the first item on the agenda was regime change in Iraq. That was in January of 2001. And almost immediately afterwards, they started assembling people inside the Pentagon to do war planning. And so what my article talks about is the effort that began then, accelerated after 9/11, and then really took off in August of 2002 to create pretext for going to war. And when I say pretext, to look for weapons of mass destruction and ties between Iraq and terrorism, which didn't exist, and then to use those basically exaggerated threat charges to justify the push for war.
Maybe you could go through some of the names of the officials within the Pentagon system and other areas of the government that supplied this information or were used by the White House to furnish the information.
Well, the first thing to say is that most of the people who eventually assembled on the eve of the war were like a fraternity of people, co-thinkers or ideologues who'd been beating the drums for war against Iraq for a decade or more. And they were all gradually kind of one by one, like the Blues Brothers getting the band back together, were brought into the Pentagon, into this unit. None of them were intelligence professionals. Most of them were kind of advocates and agitators, but not really trained in intelligence detail. The person who organized the effort from the top was Douglas Feith, who's the Undersecretary for Policy. He works directly under the Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz, who's the Deputy Secretary. So Doug Feith was really in charge of the effort. And the next down the list was a guy named Bill Luddy, who headed the Near East South Asia, called NISA, office at the Pentagon, where the actual planning for the war took place. Bill Luddy was a former aide to Newt Gingrich, who was given essentially the portfolio for planning the war. And he worked with a guy named Harold Rody, who'd been in the Pentagon for 20 years, a neoconservative specialist on the Middle East and Islam, who speaks four Middle Eastern languages. And they're the ones who started trying to recruit the talent for this secret intelligence office. The first person they brought in right after 9/11 was a guy named David Wormser. David was at the time not even a Pentagon employee. He was the director of Middle East policy for the American Enterprise Institute, which is the think tank in Washington where many of the neoconservatives take up residence as fellows. Among the people who were there are people like Richard Perle and Newt Gingrich, both of whom are leading advocates for the war effort. So beginning with David Wormser, they started putting together this team, and it built up to a pretty powerful group of several dozen people, perhaps up to 100 when you count the consultants and the people they brought in to talk to them once in a while, who created the intelligence rationale to justify the threat and to make Saddam into a much more powerful boogeyman than he really is or was.
Robert Dreyfus, in your investigation, did you find that the information supplied to Dick Cheney and eventually to George W. Bush stating the threat that they thought emanated from Iraq and justifying the U.S. invasion, was this information known to be false by the people who produced it, or was there some fuzziness and wiggle room for them to claim justifiably that they really weren't aware of the erroneous nature of what they were presenting?
Well, of course, it depends on which particular aspect of this you're talking about. Certainly, in some parts of it, they knew that it was either false or wildly exaggerated. If you're trying to find out, let's say, about Saddam Hussein's relationship to terrorist organizations, well, there may be 10,000 or 100,000 bits of information, you know, interviews that the CIA has done, articles, intercepted communications, documents, et cetera, just mounds and mounds of this information. And a lot of it is going to be contradictory because some of it is going to be lies that were told. Some of it is going to be false or bogus, you know, forged documents. So if you look at those thousands and thousands of pieces of information, you can come up with a small percentage of them that justify almost any conclusion. And if you exclude the massive evidence that contradicts that, you can write a pretty scary report. If you are not an intelligence professional and you're trying to prove your case to look for information only that justifies a predetermined conclusion, then you're going to jump on and cherry pick these little bits and pieces of information. And that's what they did. And they created talking points papers, taking the most extreme information, whether it was true or not. And then that's the information that got directly into the speeches that Rumsfeld and Cheney and even the president gave in the 2 years before the war. That's not intelligence. That's propaganda. That's what dictators do, not what democracies do.
That was investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus, co-author along with Jason Vest of the article titled Lie Factory. Access the piece online by visiting Mother Jones Magazine's website at www.motherjones.com. In his first major policy initiative of the new year, President Bush proposed an overhaul of the nation's immigration laws. The initiative, announced on January 7th, would allow some 8 million undocumented immigrants currently in the U.S. to obtain legal status as temporary workers. The program, if passed by Congress, would offer legal status to employed immigrants for 3 years with a one-time opportunity for renewal, but would offer no new avenues to those seeking U.S. citizenship. While President Bush emphasized the plan's capacity to improve security along the nation's borders, many observers charged that the White House proposed the program, hoping to gain crucial Hispanic votes in the upcoming presidential election. The initiative drew both praise and criticism from the Latino community, but many conservatives and advocates of immigration reform were quick to criticize Mr. Bush's updated guest worker program. The National Council of La Raza, the nation's largest Latino civil rights organization, said in a statement, the Bush proposal is a bitter disappointment that will relegate immigrants to second-class status. John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, warned that the Bush immigration plan would create a permanent legal underclass of low-paid workers. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Anna Avendano, senior advisor on immigration issues for the AFL-CIO, who explains why the labor movement opposes the president's immigration plan.
The strength of the proposal is really that it sheds a light on an issue that is of critical importance to workers all over the country U.S. citizens, legal residents, and undocumented workers, and that is that the immigration reform is absolutely necessary, that our immigration laws as they are today are really ineffective, inefficient, and in the long run, they really work against workers. So the fact that the president has proposed some reform, the fact that the president and the White House recognize that something needs to be done is very, very, very positive. What that is the big question here, is what needs to be done? The problem with the president's proposal to begin with is that it really doesn't offer any real hope for the millions of immigrant workers that are affected by the proposal. We don't have a path to any legalization. We don't really have a path so that the 8 or 9 million folks who are now working hard, paying their taxes in the United States, will someday be able to be a real part of our communities or our society. They are forever to remain temporary.
The president's supporters might argue that providing some sort of legal status for undocumented immigrants who are now in the United States would go a long way to preventing some of the exploitation that's now taking place in that group in the workplace. Would you respond to that?
Sure. I mean, I think that we need to look at the reality of what it means to work in the industries that we're talking about and what the president is proposing. What the president is proposing is for folks to be able to have a 3-year temporary permit to work for a particular employer under terms and conditions set by that employer. It's clear from the proposal that the employers are going to be petitioning for people. The employers are going to retain control over the workers and sole control over the workers under temporary status, so that if an employee gets fired, they're going to lose that temporary permit. So it isn't much relief that workers are getting by getting this temporary permit. That's still conditioned on working for a particular employer. And then the question becomes, what happens at the end of 3 years?
What are some elements of a reform of the current immigration laws that the AFL-CIO would like to see in place here in this country, as opposed to what President Bush has proposed?
Well, I think that the key component of any immigration reform has to be that folks have to have a path to citizenship. It doesn't mean that anyone's going to get a pass. It doesn't mean that anybody is supporting amnesty. What we're talking about is that the people who have been working hard in this country, who have been paying their taxes, who have been contributing to a society, should get some benefit from all of their work. And that is that by continuing to do just that, work hard, pay taxes, at the end of the day, they're going to be able to sort of get on a path that's going to someday give them a green card. And a green card is something symbolic that for folks, what it means is that I'm going to be able to stay in this country, to stay in my community, to buy a house, to set up roots so that I can share in the American dream. I can have a voice in democracy. I can someday vote. I can take ownership of my job, of my life, of my community. So, that is the path to legalization that is the absolute essential component of any immigration reform proposal that the labor movement and workers in general are going to support.
Tell us a little bit about the evolution of the AFL-CIO and the union movement's thinking about immigration. It wasn't all that long ago when the union movement wasn't four square behind legalizing immigrant status. That certainly has changed. The AFL-CIO did a big push this past fall. It's culminated in a national march and freedom ride. Tell us the change of thinking, if you would, on how the labor movement views immigrants as allies.
It's been my experience that we sort of tend to focus on sort of what's going on in the moment, but I think it's like it's important to take a sort of a bigger historical perspective on how the labor movement has welcomed immigrant workers. And I think one of the industries that's the most interesting to look at that is the meatpacking industry. That's an immigrant industry. And instead of having Polish immigrants, now the meatpacking industry is predominantly Latino immigrants. It went through a transition. We had, Eastern European immigrants be part of the packing industry at one point. So really, the immigrant population within the labor movement has always been there. I think that there was a lot of focus in the last few years about tensions within the labor movement about, what is the proper role of immigrants. One of the things that is definitely new to our nation as a whole, not just to the labor movement, is the fact that there's a population of workers who have been left behind, that there's 8 million people without a voice on the job. And yes, the labor movement has struggled somewhat in figuring out what do we do about this population of workers. And I think that the answer that we've come up with is the correct one, is that we have to organize folks. We have to educate this population about what their rights are, how their rights should be enforced, because that really is for the benefit of everybody.
That was Anna Avendano, Senior Advisor on Immigration Issues with the AFL-CIO. Contact the Labor Federation by calling area code 202-637-5000 or visit their website at www.aflcio.org. Over the past decade, in the hills of Kentucky and West Virginia, coal companies have been literally blowing the tops off selected Appalachian mountains to get to the coal seams underneath. Mining firms then dump the debris into mountain streams. The disruption from blasting, air pollution, and especially the flooding that accompanies mountaintop removal has driven many residents of the Mountain Hollow communities out of their homes and buried their history. Citizens in the affected areas and their environmental supporters have won two victories at the state level to stop the practice. They base their efforts on two federal laws, the Clean Water Act and the Surface Mining Act. But they suffered setbacks in federal appeals court and when the Bush administration rewrote the Clean Water Act rules, removing stream protections that citizens claim coal companies were violating. In addition, last week the White House proposed the weakening of surface mining rules that also protect streams. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joan Mulhern, Senior Legislative Counsel at Earth Justice, a legal and environmental advocacy group, about the politics of coal and what opponents of mountaintop removal are hoping to achieve with their campaign.
There is no law, no federal environmental law, against blowing up mountains. However, there are at least two federal laws that prohibit the burial and destruction of streams. Basically, what's going on is citizens have been trying to defend themselves in court because the Bush administration's agencies, as well as the state agencies that are charged by law with protecting the environment, are not doing their jobs. So the citizens are trying to protect themselves. And every time they do, every time they try to go to court with a different argument to the judge about how the companies are violating the law, the Bush administration tries to change the law, basically to try to sort of outmaneuver the citizens. So they're essentially protecting the coal companies from the public.
Does Stephen Griles, the Deputy Director of the Interior Department, have anything to do with this?
Stephen Griles has very much to do with the Bush administration's policies to favor the coal companies over the public and over the environment. Stephen Griles is a former coal industry lobbyist and executive, and he represented those industries for many years before being appointed to the number two post at the Interior Department. The Interior Department oversees the Office of Surface Mining, which is supposed to be the watchdog over the coal industry, and it is the agency charged with enforcing the stream buffer zone rule, the very rule that the Bush administration announced this week it was planning to change. And we have a variety of memos and interagency communications that were obtained through the Freedom of Information Act that shows that Stephen Griles was at the center of the effort to weaken environmental laws that apply to the coal companies. He's being investigated by the Inspector General of the Interior Department. One of that agency's roles is to root out, you know, violations of ethics laws, and that's what Griles is being investigated for. When he was appointed, he signed a recusal agreement that said he would recuse himself. He would stay away from any matter that involved his former clients. And on mountaintop removal and other issues involving the coal companies, he's done anything but stay away. He's been right in the center of it. And those are the kinds of allegations that the investigators at the Inspector General's office are looking into.
What has the role been of the United Mine Workers in this struggle? Have they supported the citizens? Obviously, they're citizens as well. They live there. But they also have jobs tied to mountaintop removal. Have they supported or opposed it?
On mountaintop removal, unfortunately, and I think it's very sad, the mine workers and the citizens who are trying to rein in the abuses of mountaintop removal haven't seen eye to eye. I think because the coal companies threaten that if they can't continue to blow up the mountains and bury the streams, that they'll take jobs away. One of the ironies of this is that the number of mine workers in West Virginia and Kentucky has dropped dramatically over the last several decades, especially in recent years, I believe in large part because mining, like mountaintop removal, has become so mechanized. You only need one person to drive this giant drag line that takes a bite out of the mountain the size of two trailway buses at one swoop. So you don't need the same number of workers, and consequently, since the 1960s, the number of mine workers in West Virginia, not just because of mountaintop removal, but I think that's certainly been a contributing factor over the last decade, the number of miners has gone down just in West Virginia from 100,000 to 17,000 today. Less than a third of them work on mountaintop removal sites. Because not all the surface mining in Appalachia is actually blowing up the mountains. There's other kinds of surface mining where they sort of more carefully strip out the coal. I mean, there's still, of course, huge environmental impacts from those forms of coal mining as well, but nothing touches mountaintop removal when it comes to just utter destruction of the environment.
Is your goal and the goal of the citizens' groups to stop the process of mountaintop removal altogether or just clean it up?
I would say that most of the organizations, including ours, do not support mountaintop removal coal mining and would like to see that practice ended. There are other forms of coal mining, while they have their own problems, aren't nearly as destructive. I think the situation, though, right now that the citizens and environmental groups are facing is even more dire. We're just trying at the moment, sort of as step one, to get the law enforced and to require the coal mining industry to respect the same federal environmental laws that all other industries have to follow, that they can't sort of wantonly destroy streams and other resources without any limits, which is what the Bush administration is trying to let them do.
That was Joan Mulhern of Earth Justice. For more information, call the group at area code 202-667-4500 or visit their website at www.earthjustice.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.